Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. The Chelsea Hotel played home to New York City's bohemian art scene for a hugely influential chunk of the 20th century, bringing together artists, musicians, junkies, gangsters, and gamblers under one roof. It's where Dee Dee Ramone wrote punk songs and where Sid and Nancy entered the vernacular forever. It's also where Andy Warhol's circle gathered and where Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix took up residence. But rent at the hotel, which dates to 1883, is now through the iconic roof, and its era as an artist's haven is past. The days of creativity and debauchery are very much alive in the pages of James Locke's new oral history, This Ain't No Holiday Inn, Down and Out at the Chelsea Hotel, 1980-1995, which is published by Schaffner Press. James Locke is the former director of the writing program at Savannah College of Art and Design, where he still teaches, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Why did you specifically focus on this 15-year stretch of the Chelsea Hotel?
Well, I'd like to say I had a better reason than I knew the people who lived there at that time, but that was the reason. My brother-in-law used to tell me stories that he knew the first beat writer. He said, "You ever heard of Herbert Hunky?" And I said, "No, I've never heard of Herbert Hunky, and I think I know the Beats pretty well. I used to live in San Francisco and Denver, which were two beat cities." And he said, "Well, he was the first beat writer." Well, lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, I went and read the Denver Post book review, and there was the collected works of Herbert Hunky, and I thought, maybe my brother-in-law is telling something worthwhile. And then a bit later, he and I were driving, and we heard on the radio that Dee Dee Ramone had died, and I thought, well, that's too bad, but hardly unexpected since he was a heroin addict, and apparently he did OD on heroin. And he said, my brother-in-law said, "You don't understand. I used to play in a band with Dee Dee Ramone at the Chelsea Hotel. We were good friends." And after I heard that, I figured, well, wow, if Robert was hanging out with Dee Dee Ramone at the Chelsea Hotel and with the first beat writer at the Chelsea Hotel in the 80s and early 90s, we probably had a book here.
So what was it actually like in that era in the hotel? What were the rooms like? What did it look like? What did it sound like?
Well, it all depended on where you lived in the hotel. It's a 12-story building. At the time it was built, it was the tallest building in New York City. But the floors of the hotel were arranged sort of like the social strata of society in general. On the lowest floors, floors 1 and 2, you had the poor fledgling artists who didn't have much money and who paid very low rent. The rooms were cramped. You generally didn't have a bathroom in the room. You had to use a bathroom down the hall. And this is where all the young, poor artists who were just trying to make it moved in. Toward the middle of the hotel, the rooms got nicer, and they were a little more established artists. They could pay a little more rent. And then at the top of the hotel, that's where the luxury apartments were. Some of them were 3,000 square feet. That's where the artists who had really made it lived, like Tom Waits or Philip Glass or Virgil Thompson, the great Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. So they lived in luxurious apartments on the top floors, while the young fledgling artists lived in dumps down on the lower floors, and often the two really didn't know too much about each other's lives. A wonderful thing about the Chelsea was that it was very well insulated. The rooms were very, very quiet because back when it was built in 1883, they poured sand inside the interior walls. The reason was to prevent fires from spreading from room to room, and you can see photographs of flames shooting horizontally out of windows in the Chelsea Hotel. It's really a stunning thing to see. And the room will have been demolished, but none of the rooms around them were affected because of that sand poured into these 9-inch interior walls. Well, why was that great for artists? Because you could get quiet there. If you were a writer, you could have a nice quiet room. If you had a rock and roll band and you practiced in your room, you wouldn't bother the people next to you. So just by accident, in that sense, the Chelsea was a great place for artists as well.
You know, you can kind of imagine how once a place gains a reputation, why other artists would then flock there. But how did it first start to attract artists who eventually would be, you know, the famous names that I listed off at the beginning?
Well, it's got a long history of attracting artists. It started with the manager, co-owner Stanley Bard's father, David Bard, who owned the hotel in the early 1900s. They were from a cultivated Hungarian family that always appreciated the arts. So when they were given a chance to let an artist stay there, and by the way, the Chelsea was a residence hotel, so you could go there either as a tourist for a few nights, or you could stay there as a resident, like renting an apartment. So the early owners liked to have artists come. And in the early days, Mark Twain stayed there, the writer O. Henry stayed there, the famous actresses Sarah Bernhardt and Lily Langtry stayed there. Sarah Bernhardt actually lived on the top floor. She was very successful, and she had a pyramid, a glass pyramid built in her room under which she slept. She thought that was good for her, and she slept in her own casket underneath that pyramid. So there was a lot of eccentricity at the hotel. When David Bard's son, Stanley, took over the hotel in the 1950s, then he really pumped in the artist-friendly atmosphere. He put it on steroids. So he really started to cultivate writers, artists, musicians, painters, playwrights to come live there, and he would invite them. So people like Dylan Thomas lived there, Tennessee Williams, William Burroughs, the painter William de Kooning, Virgil Thompson, as mentioned earlier, lived there. And then the Chelsea really hit its stride. Once it gained its reputation as a place for artists, then more and more artists wanted to come there because they knew it was an artist-friendly place. So, as you said, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, Jimi Hendrix, Gore Vidal, the novelist, Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote Lolita, stayed there, as well as the more well-known artists like Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe, which made it famous in her book Almost Famous. So because artists had lived there before and because the Bard family, the managers, were known to be artist-friendly, it established that reputation. And then later on, the younger artists decided, well, I want to be part of that too. I want to be part of that tradition. I want a little of that creativity to rub off on me.
Say more a little, if you can, about the Bard ownership, because they kind of developed this reputation as a Noah of artists and artworks, but you make the point that that was not always the best way to run a business, per se.
Well, Stanley Bard really mastered this policy of letting artists in, and I call him kind of, he used the policy of the steel fist inside the velvet glove. The fact is he was renting rooms to fledgling artists who aren't always known for being the most dependable, and he would let them in on a dime. He would let them, if they showed any potential at all, he might waive the damage deposit. Some months he might even waive a month's rent and say, oh, it's okay, just become a successful artist, and when you sell your artwork, you can pay me. Sometimes he even accepted artwork in lieu of payment. So Stanley Bard, I'm sure, has a very wonderful collection of artwork at his home where he lives now. So that was part of his policy, is that he was very lenient with his artists when he let them in. But the fact is, because so many of them, especially the newer ones on the lower floors, were not necessarily dependable, he always had to hound them for the rent. So he was always badgering them if they were behind on the rent. He would call them at 8 in the morning when they were most likely still in bed and say, management wants to talk to you. Come down here and pay your rent. He would just hound them. So it was this weird steel fist in a velvet glove. He would let them in, and then if they stopped paying rent, he would be merciless on them. But he knew how to make this hotel make money, was the thing. Unlike the owner's sense, he knew how to ride economies. For one, he knew that when the economy was bad, he had to rent to certain types of people who could always pay. And the people that could always pay their rents were drug dealers and prostitutes and pimps, because they always had money and they always paid on time. And then when the economy improved and got better, he could kick those folks out of the hotel. He knew how to attract tourists to the hotel to visit the famous artists. So that was a big part of his money-making idea, too, is that if you had enough famous artists in the hotel, then that would attract tourists from all over the world to come see this infamous Chelsea Hotel. So he really did have a sort of unstated business plan that helped the Chelsea stay above water while contributing to our cultural scene and helping many, many artists. The list of artists that stayed there is just astonishing. I call the Chelsea the most productive and long-standing artist colony in the United States that never called itself an artist colony.
Hmm. New York City has changed in the last 20 years, and I think a lot of the stuff that would have happened at the Chelsea during this era is now happening maybe out in Brooklyn and so on. But is there a price to be paid for, you know, this space not being available anymore as really Manhattan becomes more and more gentrified and the class structure, you know, becomes a little bit more set in stone, and it basically becomes a more expensive place to live no matter what you're doing?
Yeah, gentrification is great for the real estate developers, and it quote-unquote improves neighborhoods, but it decimates bohemian artist communities and communities of color and working-class communities, and that's what's happened in New York. You're absolutely right about that. And it started, around 20 years ago. It really hit its stride in the real estate bubble in the 2000s, around 2005 through 2010. And New York is a very different place right now. It's a city for wealthy people. Now, yes, it has moved to Brooklyn and Williamsburg, and these places are actually becoming more expensive now, too, and they're becoming prohibitive for young fledgling artists that don't come from upper middle class or wealthy families. And I see this as a real shame because our culture needs places where rent is cheap, but also has that big stimulating urban environment that new places like New York or San Francisco can provide to young artists. They may be able to afford living in smaller towns, and they may be able to create artistic scenes in those small towns too, but I just can't imagine they're going to be extremely powerful, extremely vibrant, diverse scenes like they would be in the big cities. But the big cities, unfortunately, are just becoming much too expensive for young artists to move to. So they're going to have to find other ways of building artistic, bohemian, counterculture communities.
We've been speaking with James Locke. He's the author of This Ain't No Holiday Inn, Down and Out at the Chelsea Hotel, 1980 to 1995. And the book is out now from Schaffner Press. James, a real pleasure to speak with you, and I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ian.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.